You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, October 24th, 2007, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey everybody, good to be back.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hi everyone, good to have you back, Bob.
Yeah, it's been... Wow.
It's been too long. What, 3 weeks you bailed on us?
Bailed? Well, it's just been such an interesting, busy month.
Yeah.
I can't even explain. And it's not over.
We have an intimate crew tonight, just the three of us. Rebecca was not feeling well this evening, so she was unable to finish the show. And Jay, something about his wife's birthday or something today. I mean, that guy's got his priorities all screwed up.
Yeah.
Yeah, right? No kidding.
Got to do his intervention or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. He should have been here and invited her on as a special birthday guest, but that didn't happen.
I think she's got better ideas than joining the podcast for her birthday.
We have an interview coming up later in the episode with Joe Nickel, who's going to talk to us about his two new books. But first, let's get to some news. Actually, Evan, you usually do the National Day thing, but I have one that I found for this week. Today... Uh-huh. Today is National Acupuncture Propaganda Day.
I can't beat that one.
But they're calling it National Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine Day. Aims to educate consumers about the benefits of using acupuncture.
The benefits?
So it is just propaganda. Let's try to spread the word, which, you know,
if it
really worked, you wouldn't need a National Propaganda Day for acupuncture.
Well, how did something like that even get started? I mean, who says, let's make today National Acupuncture Day? I mean, does it need to be ratified or...
Let me guess, yeah. Spearheaded by the National Certification Commission of Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine.
Right.
NCCAOM. So, gee.
That's the same as us declaring National Skeptics Day.
Skeptic Day. That's true. Hey, I like
which
that.
Which we should do. We should. Why not?
We'll
pick a day, some Wednesday when we're recording, when there's nothing else going on. We'll just declare this International Skeptics Day.
Shouldn't it be Friday the 13th, or should we not combine those two?
Yeah, we don't want anything to distract from Skeptics Day.
Okay.
That's great.
All right, so we'll pick a day. So keep your eyes open for that.
But Steve, acupuncture, according to this article, is a viable form of medicine with a 3,000-year history. So how can we even question this?
The argument from antiquity.
Nice.
Which is a form of the argument from authority. And it presumes that antiquity gives authority. So it's kind of a double whammy. Next news item is a minor shameless plug for myself. In the latest issue of the Skeptical Inquirer, which just came out, the cover article is called Vaccines and Autism, and it was written by yours truly.
No shit. I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
Holy crap.
Got a few extra copies. I'll give
cover
you one.
Article. Wow.
Yep. Right. Vaccines and Autism, Myths and Misconceptions. I've been writing about this for a long time. I have a dozen or so blog entries on this. I wrote a very long article about it a couple of years ago. And so this is the compilation of everything that I've been writing about it into one sort of cohesive long article, really just covering it from beginning to end. So I definitely recommend that you pick up a copy of the Skeptical Inquirer. If you don't know about this journal, this is the magazine of the CSI, formerly PsyCop. It is definitely an excellent skeptical journal. I read every issue cover to cover. I've been doing it for years. It's a great way to learn about, you know, all the various topics within the skeptical community, and it has very good writers. So I do recommend it. And we will have links to the website on from our notes page. You pick it up on the newsstand or in the bookstore, or you can order it off the website. And I believe they still will send you one free issue if you ask them to. You can just request one off the website. Now, of course, print journalism is just so slow these days, you know, compared to blogging and podcasting. By the time my article went from being written to being published, the stories have already moved forward. There's already been developments in the the vaccines and autism story. Of course, the bottom line of all this is that vaccines do not cause autism. There is no association between any of the vaccines or mercury in vaccines and autism. But there is a dedicated group of anti-vaccination ideologues and the so-called Mercury Militia, I love that name, who will twist logic and evidence to fit their ideology and are causing a lot of problems and a lot of mischief. The things that happened since I wrote the article, my article does not cover it. There was the Jennifer McCarthy flap, you know, where she came out with her book saying that her mommy instinct trumps all of science, and she's making the rounds. There was another news item that is related to this came out after I wrote the article, and that is the observation that there is increasing use of the religious exemption for parents to keep their kids from getting vaccinated prior to getting into school. Now, the United States, unlike many other countries, requires vaccination in order to get into school, the public school system, but many of the individual states have exemptions for religious reasons. So if getting vaccinated is against your religious beliefs, you can ask for an exemption.
And but your kid will still be able to go to school.
And your kid will still be able to go to school, and you're basically benefiting off of the herd immunity from everyone else getting their kids immunized. But what a lot of parents who are either scared off the vaccines because of all of the vaccine and autism misinformation that's out there, or are ideologically anti-vaccination or whatever, for whatever reason they do not want to vaccinate their kids, they just lie and say they have a religious reason not to get vaccinated, even though they don't. It's based upon something philosophical or their fears of vaccines.
So these schools just go by your word.
Yes. Yeah. You don't have to prove that you have a membership in any specific church or religious belief. You just have to check the box. Religious exemption.
You don't add loophole.
You don't need a note from your priest or minister or anything. Nice.
Yeah. Now, the percentages are still low overall. It's just a few thousand kindergartners out of the 3.7 million children entering kindergarten in 2005. So the percentages are still quite low, and there is still a very high degree of compliance in the U.S. with vaccinations, which is a good thing. But the concerning thing is that the number of exemptions is acutely on the rise over the last few years. So all of the anti-vaccine hysteria is starting to drive up these numbers. And we have to keep an eye on this. If it gets too high, then you lose the benefits of herd immunity. You get to this critical point where diseases have an easier time spreading through the population because there's more potential targets for them to spread to. So they basically ruin it for the rest of us, you know, by refusing to vaccinate their kids, they decrease the efficacy of the vaccination program. There are other issues related to this. The one really controversial issue is whether or not pharmaceutical companies should be protected from liability if they produce vaccines. Now, of course, this drives the anti-vaccinationist nuts because it looks like Big Pharma is getting their lackeys in the Congress to protect them from liability. But what really is happening is that pharmaceutical companies don't want to produce vaccines because it's a huge liability. And if they are producing a safe and effective product, even if the truth is on their side, they're still liable to, you know, quacks and cranks and hysterics who are going to try to sue them over problems that don't exist. The historical example is Dow Chemical made the silicone breast implants, were basically sued into bankruptcy and had to close down their silicone production, even though in the final analysis, after all the data was in, there was no medical harm done by the silicone breast implants.
I almost hope it starts to come down to court cases eventually in which school systems are going to start sending kids home that don't get vaccinated and say, see you in court. You know, you got no leg to stand
that,
on.
You know, that might happen. I would not be shocked if that happened if we have a pandemic, which we talked about last week on the show, if you remember, or if there really is a threat of bioterrorism. If the threat becomes enough, there will be public pressure for more compulsory vaccination and isolation of those who do not get vaccinated. I do not think that that's an implausible scenario.
Steve, you mentioned how these people, several thousand kindergartners out of the millions don't have, and they're kind of like riding along with the herd immunity. Now, the ratio, the numbers that you gave, it's a fraction of a percent. Is there a certain critical mass of students that would need to be not vaccinated in order for
in order for the herd immunity to break down? Yeah, and it's actually not that much. It's only a few percent. You know, you get to about 5 to 10% unvaccinated. That's enough for the virus to be able to jump from host to host and to spread.
That's great. Right. You know, that's about the active listening audience of Oprah Winfrey's show.
Exactly.
Probably 5% of the 5% of the population.
Right. Right.
So if they all take that the Jenny McCarthy's of the world seriously when it comes to this stuff, we got a big problem on our
Absolutely.
Hands.
Well, let's move to the next news item. We've talked in the past about the movie Expelled, which features Ben Stein. This is essentially intelligent design propaganda. And the big propaganda thing they've been on recently, you know, culminating in this movie, which is coming out in a few months in February of 08, is that the proponents of creationism and intelligent design are being persecuted. They're being persecuted by academia, by the academics, and by scientists. And it's their free speech is being impeded. It's all nonsense. Ben Stein was recently on the Bill O'Reilly Show. Did you guys have an opportunity to look at this video?
I've read the transcript.
So we have a link to the transcript and to the video. It is just incredible. I mean, Ben Stein and Bill O'Reilly were like Tweedledee and Tweedledummer. I mean, it was incredible. Neither of them had a clue. I mean, it was embarrassing. They were talking about evolution and intelligent design and, again, about the persecution of the free speech and the freedoms of people who are just trying to have all the evidence and all the arguments on the table. And, you know, Bill O'Reilly in particular said everything he said was just betrayed absolute cluelessness about evolution. He made all the common mistakes. He equated the origin of life with the subsequent evolution of life. He's saying that they were the same thing.
Well, he also maybe it was a good thing that he did. He kind of compared creationism with intelligent design, which is something that
his
ideas would not like. And
everyone pointed that out. He correctly, although probably inadvertently, equated the creationism and intelligent design, which probably was irritating to the ideas who were trying to be coy about who they think the big designer is.
Right. He must not have gotten the memo.
Right, right.
To not mix those two.
Here's one quote from Stein that really jumped out at me. He said these words: Darwinism, and of course he's referring to it as Darwinism and not theory of evolution. Darwinism, which was a brilliant theory, and blah, 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 and then a few lines down below, the theory has so many holes in it, and it's such a weak theory. Well, which is it? Is it brilliant or is it weak?
I think he was trying to say it was brilliant maybe 200 years ago or 150 years ago, but now we know that it's full of holes. What? That's like the opposite of the truth. In fact, in the last 150 years, the theory has been bolstered and has stood up to every possible challenge.
It is
more solid now than it ever was. The far bigger misconception, he said, was now we know how incredibly complex a single cell is. As if, you know, back in Darwin's day, they didn't know how complex cells were, so it was reasonable to hypothesize that it sprung up out of nothing. Now we know how complex they are. You hear that a lot from the ideas and the creationists. You know, a single cell creature took 3 billion years to evolve.
Mm-hmm.
The complexity that we see in a cell, all of that complex biochemical machinery, all the complex microscopic structure, 3 billion years to evolve, right? That's a lot of evolution, much more than the evolution of single-celled creatures to all of the complexity of multicellular life. So it's ridiculous to try to make it seem as if evolutionists are saying that, you know, a single complex modern cell arose spontaneously. The whole discussion back and forth, they were just lobbing straw men back and forth. One other thing that struck me was O'Reilly said at some point that he doesn't understand what he calls secular progressivist. That's his buzzword. That's his boogeyman, the secular progressivist. He doesn't understand their position. I believe him when he says that. That's a huge red flag. You know, you should always try to understand the opposition's opinion. You don't have to agree with it. You can say that their logic is invalid and their facts are wrong, but you should at least understand how they are constructing and arriving at their own conclusions. And I think, you know, O'Reilly was honest and accurate when he said he doesn't understand the other side. He doesn't understand the scientific position. That's his problem. He doesn't understand it.
And one other quote that I like hearing people say this, Ben Stein's in. And you know, Einstein worked within the framework of believing there was a God. Well, I mean, how many times have we read the quote from Einstein, 1954, "I do not believe in a personal God"? I mean, they just keep saying that over and over.
Yeah.
I mean, am I just...
Yeah, that's a non sequitur.
Is that an incorrect quote from Einstein? I mean,
you're absolutely right. Yeah, I mean, he didn't work within the framework of believing God. He wasn't interjecting supernaturalism or God into his construction of the cosmos. He was working completely within a scientific framework. So that's just absolutely wrong. They're trying to say that, again, the boogeymen,
arguing from authority,
secular progressivists of today are so oppressive and so oppressive to free speech that we wouldn't even allow Einstein to do his investigations, or Darwin. You know, it's ridiculous.
Right.
It's
lame.
It is completely lame.
Right.
Since we're talking about creationism and ID, I have to also point out that I came across a press release today, and this is one of the most stupid and ridiculous scientific press releases I've ever read. I was stunned at how ridiculous this was. The title is "Study Casts Doubt on Creationism." So this is a study about looking at the Saint Bernard and comparing the modern Saint Bernard, the contemporary Saint Bernard, to specimens, you know, skull specimens from hundreds of years ago, showing that, you know, yeah, there are differences, that the Saint Bernard, because of breeding, because of artificial selection, changed over time. What does that have to do with creationism? Nothing. I mean, it's like, first of all, this is actually barely has anything to do with evolution, but taking a study that maybe is more evidence for evolution and saying that a study casts doubt on creationism is like saying, new satellite data casts doubt on the flat Earth theory. Why even bring it up?
Right.
It's ridiculous. And the opening line was, "The St. Bernard dog, named after the 11th century priest Bernard of Menthon, may have ironically challenged the theory of creationism," say scientists.
The theory?
First of all, the theory of creation, there is no theory of creationism. It's not a scientific theory. And I guess they were playing off the irony of St. Bernard. I mean, that is thin.
Like they wrote a whole story around just that one idea.
Now, wait a minute. You didn't get this from The Onion, Steve, because, you know, that's a satirical source.
Nope. This is a legitimate press release. Nope. This is, and that's a good thought, Evan. It's so bad you almost might think it's satirical. In fact, you know, I almost think that maybe this was written by a creationist just to look really bad, just to give themselves fodder to talk about, because that's what all this really serves. It's so bad that all it does is just give the creationist fodder, because it's a big straw man. You know, creationists don't say that breeds of animals don't change over historical time. I mean, that's too historically documented. They just say that, it's still a St. Bernard.
Microevolution.
It's microevolution. It's also artificial selection. It's not natural selection.
That's the only evolution they really allow, really.
So this is really just serving up a straw man to the creationists. It's embarrassing. I was just shocked at how terrible this press release was.
Who wrote that?
It's terrible. The source is the University of Manchester. So it's some bozo at the University of Manchester who put out this press release. They should be fired.
Yeah, have him turn in his big shoes and his red nose.
And you know we're going to be hearing about this from the Discovery Institute and the other propaganda organs of ID, because it's just too easy for them. A bit of follow-up from last week. Last week we talked about James Watson, one of the co-discoverers of the structure of DNA.
A little hubbub around that little discussion last week, huh?
Just a little.
There always is whenever we talk about anything so politically charged, like racism.
All right.
Well, last week we mentioned that, you know, in a lecture tour that Watson was giving, he made some very...
inflammatory?
Yeah, very inflammatory comments, calling into question the intelligence of Africans, you know, for example. And, of course, it was denounced as racist, which the statements were. And, you know, we were reporting on this last Wednesday when this had just happened. Well, since then, there's been quite a bit of fallout. First of all, James Watson has tried to backpedal on his statements. This is what he says. "I cannot understand how I could have said what I am quoted as having said. If I said what I was quoted as saying, then I can only admit that I am bewildered by it. To those who have drawn the inference from my words that Africa, as a continent, is somehow genetically inferior, I can only apologize unreservedly. That is not what I meant." He goes on to say, "There is no scientific basis for such a belief." So he's backpedaling from what he said. Of course, his comments were recorded, and I don't think it was they were reported in error. They're fairly well documented. So, you know, I don't know if he really doesn't remember saying those words, even though it looks like he did. If he's, you know, being sincere in completely backpedaling now, or if he's just trying to cover up the exposure of his real underlying beliefs, which I think is what people are assuming. The backlash has been pretty significant, too. He was his tour was canceled.
Oh.
Also, he was serving as the chancellor of the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory in New York, and they fired him. They let him go from that position.
Wow.
What this shows is that there is no one so legendary in their reputation, so entrenched in their academic position, that their career cannot crash and burn because of these types of statements.
Did you hear that he also had to give back his Nobel Prize?
No.
I just made that up.
Yeah. Yeah, that doesn't happen. That you can't take that away from him.
No.
No.
So, I mean, it's always unfortunate to see somebody who is a respected scientist embarrass themselves. Kind of reminds me of Linus Pauling,
right?
A brilliant scientist.
Yep.
And at the end of his career, just went completely nuts and became a crank, essentially a vitamin C crank at the end of his career. It's unfortunate.
Winds up, detracting from the points.
Yeah. One last quick news item. This is another installment in our ongoing series of the dangers of belief in the paranormal. A woman returned home to find her house full of smoke and on fire. And guess how this happened? She had...
Spontaneous combustion. Human combustion.
Semi-spontaneous combustion. She had a crystal ball on some windowsill or counter, and it picked up the light just right, amplified it, and set the curtains on fire.
What, from the sun, like coming through the window or something?
Yeah, it was a lens.
How did they determine that?
Yeah.
When I first read that, my first thought was, wait, a crystal ball focusing light? That didn't seem quite right to me. I did some research on it and found one optical website, and this guy was claiming that basically if you have a transparent material that's got a curved side, then it can be a lens. It can be used to focus light. So I guess it is possible, but
yeah, it's possible. This is the claim of the firefighters.
Right.
So I don't know if the crystal was still focusing the light and they said, maybe that, you know, sparked a flame. Maybe it was pointing in the area. Her house didn't burn down or anything, but, you know, the curtain certainly burned up. Obviously, this isn't a direct result of her belief in the paranormal. It's just a funny item that was sent to us.
Yeah, it's called irony.
Right.
She didn't see this one coming.
Let's go on to your questions and emails. The first one is a quick follow-up from last week. The science or fiction items all surrounded honey, and I mentioned that bees make honey from pollen. Several readers wrote in to correct me on that. This is one from Bill Jeffries from Moortown, Vermont, and he writes, "Hi there. On this week's show, the meme got started that bees make honey out of pollen. It was repeated by several of you. Bees do not make honey out of pollen. They make it out of nectar. Pollen is largely protein. Nectar is basically sugar water, which is converted into honey by evaporation and the action of bee enzymes. Pollen is used as a proteinaceous food." Well, that's exactly correct, so thank you for pointing that out, Bill. Many insects and bees use pollen, and many types of insects also drink the nectar from flowers as well, but honeybees are the only ones that hit upon a way of condensing the nectar through curing it or evaporation, removing the moisture from it, as I did point out last week, into honey. The reason for this, or the benefit of this, is that the honey can last throughout the winter. The bees have a source of food that they can eat throughout the winter, so they can remain active, even in the cold months.
Not only last throughout the winter, I read somewhere, I don't remember where, it said, or it claimed that honey never, ever goes bad. It never spoils.
Well, Bob, you weren't here last week, but that was one of the science or fiction items from last week. And that is science.
Uh-huh.
So, yep.
Yes,
honey
yes.
never spoils. So you
good job, Bob.
You might have got it right from last week, but no credit. You weren't here.
Partial credit?
No. The next email is also a follow-up from last week. We had Mark Crislip on to tell us about the flu vaccine, and this has sparked a lot of discussion as well. This one comes from Oscar Levin. He comes from some backwater place called Connecticut. I don't know where that is.
Connect, I cut.
Right.
Gotcha.
Oscar writes, "Hi, everyone. First, let me say I absolutely love your show. I do have two questions about recent episodes, however, and I'm going to skip one and just read the other one for time." The question I'm going to answer today is, last episode you discussed some common myths about vaccination. I'm not sure if the following is common, but it was how I justified not getting vaccinated. The idea is this: by vaccinating the general population, we lose the ability to fight off diseases on our own. As the flu mutates and becomes more and more deadly, we are in greater danger of dying if we do catch the flu, simply because our bodies haven't had the chance to fight off weaker incarnations of the disease. What I'm thinking here is similar to the fear that if smallpox were released today, everyone would die because nobody has a natural resistance to it. Closely related is the reasoning that creating these medicines and vaccines causes the bugs to mutate into worse strains. Is there any reason to believe either of these, or should I just get over my fear of needles? Well, Oscar, that is completely wrong. And it is a fairly common misunderstanding. It is also a bit of propaganda that I hear repeated frequently by the anti-vaccinationists and other pseudoscientists. I've had chiropractors directly make that claim to me, that with all the vaccinations and whatnot, you're weakening the immune system. And of course, they claim that chiropractic strengthens the immune system, which is nonsense. But this is, you know, this betrays a misunderstanding of how vaccinations work. Vaccines work very differently than antibiotics. Antibiotics kill the bacteria, and they do that by exploiting some biochemical aspect of the bacteria. They're lysing their membranes or whatever. And they have to exploit something that's different between bacteria and vertebrate cells. Our cells have to be different enough that the drugs are not going to affect our cells, but they will kill the bacteria cells. So there's sort of limited mechanisms by which, you know, the antibiotics can work, and the bacteria can evolve resistance to those mechanisms. They just change their biochemistry so that the drugs do not work. Vaccines, they're not drugs that target the viruses or the bacteria. They present either a live virus or a killed virus or a piece of a virus or a bacteria, proteins that are on their outside, for example. And they do that in order to trigger your immune system to react against them. Now, the immune system has what we call an anamnestic response. It remembers what it's been exposed to before. So the second time you get exposed to something, it has a much quicker, much more vigorous immune response. So the point of being vaccinated is to prime your body's immune system, generate this immune memory so that the next time you get exposed to those same proteins or viruses, your body will have a rapid, vigorous immune response. So far from weakening your immune system, the whole purpose of a vaccine is to strengthen your immune system, specifically against the bugs that you're being vaccinated against. It also does not contribute to the generation of superbugs because it's not killing the bugs directly. It's just, you know, just stimulating your immune system to be able to do so. In fact, if anything, it would reduce the evolution of superbugs because it reduces the spread of the germs. The more these things reproduce and multiply, the greater the opportunity there is for mutations to occur. So if you prevent the viruses or bacteria from spreading in the first place, you reduce these mutations, you reduce the rate of evolution, if you will, of these bugs into superbugs. So vaccines are a win-win all around. None of these things is wrong. Now, it is true that if we wipe out a disease like smallpox, and then we stop immunizing people against smallpox, then sure, we'll have, you know, the next generation will have no immunity against the smallpox. They won't be any more vulnerable to it than anyone who's never been exposed to it. You only have immunity to smallpox because you got exposed to it in some way. So they won't be especially vulnerable to it, but there won't be anybody out there who has immunity to it. And that's why we continue to, you know, vaccinate against these diseases.
And can you actually get rid of a disease like that entirely, 100%?
Well, yeah, smallpox. It's gone.
Yeah, but don't they have, you were saying they don't have it in a jar somewhere? In a laboratory?
Oh, yeah, they do. Yeah, but it's gone from the wild.
Gotcha.
We're on the brink of eradicating polio. On the brink.
Except, isn't it making a comeback in Africa, though?
Because of fears about the vaccine.
Right.
Yep. But we'll get it. We'll get it under control.
I hope so.
Well, let's go on to our interview. Joining us now is Joe Nickel. Joe, welcome back to the Skeptics Guide.
Always a pleasure.
And Joe, you are joining us tonight to talk about your two new books. You've actually had two books come out in the last year since we interviewed you last time. The first one is Relics of the Christ, and the second one is Adventures in Paranormal Investigation. So let's start out by talking about Relics of the Christ. What's the book about beyond what we can obviously tell from the title?
Well, I started out by postulating the different views of Jesus, whether Jesus was the Messiah or a historical figure or a mythical figure. Those are pretty much the three views that people have of Jesus. And then I suggest that in order to look at those particular perspectives, we look at the relics and the physical traces of Jesus. What evidence do we have that he actually is a historical figure, and how much legend making is there through these various relics? And so I take us on a tour through such things as the Holy Grail and the True Cross and the Shroud of Turin. At the end of the book, I'll let readers find out what we get to.
So you spent a lot of time going over the Shroud of Turin evidence?
Yes, once again, you know, I mean, it's been an albatross around my neck for these many years. I'm coming to the notion that there may be two Shrouds of Turin. There seems to be the one that the true believers keep talking about that wrapped the body of a crucified man 2,000 years ago. It's not the same shroud that the rest of us are looking at that appears to be a 14th century forgery. So, I don't know, maybe there are two shrouds after all. Or could it be that we're looking at the same cloth and just approaching it from an entirely different perspectives? I think the pro-shroud people have started with the answer, mm-hmm. You know, this is the shroud of our Lord. And that process is really the opposite of what the way science works.
I'm pretty sure we've talked about the Shroud of Turin pretty extensively with you before, but I don't think we've talked about the Holy Grail. Are there any groups of people or scientists out there claiming that they actually have the Holy Grail?
Well, there are a spate of books, you know, in the wake of the Da Vinci Code particularly. There are some claimants to be the Holy Grail. You know, the term, the old French word, Saint Grail, can be, depending on how you break that word, if you divide it S-A-N-G-R-E-A-L, then it means Holy Grail. If you divide it S-A-N-G space R-E-A-L, then it means Holy Blood. And the idea that this refers either to the communion cup at the Holy Communion, the Last Supper, or that it's somehow a blood relic of Jesus, these ideas are explored in Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and other pseudo-history books.
Well, why is the French interpretation important? I don't understand the connection there.
Well, because a lot of these romances were the Grail romances come out of France, and a lot of the early Grail legends. We really don't have any story that there was a Holy Grail. You know, there's no biblical evidence that there was any either any communion cup saved as a relic, or that there was a blood of Christ was saved, but there were these Grail romances. For example, about 1190, Chrétien de Troyes wrote a famous Grail romance, and all of the others come after that, and these are just French romances. People have taken them seriously, and they have morphed into various legends. And so there are some claimants. There's in the Museum of Metropolitan Museum of Art is an Antioch chalice that's been claimed to be the Holy Grail, and it unfortunately dates from probably the 6th century, so it's not the real McCoy.
Yeah, why do they claim that? Why do they think that that's the Holy Grail?
You know, these artifacts show up, and this is the story of legends and the story of relics, is that they show up somewhere. And when you try to ask, well, where did this come from, you're told, well, it's according to the legend that we have, it came from, and then you're told some story. And the problem is that all of the relics, really, that we have that are supposed to be relics of Christ show up primarily in the Middle Ages, and they have no provenance.
Right. So it's not as if they were dug up from an archaeological site that dates to the first century, or that there is a chain of ownership from the first century into modern times. They just appear for the first time
exactly.
in history in Middle Ages.
Right. At some time, you know, somebody has it in a church, or there's some it shows up somewhere. And this is the story of most relics. I mean, look at the Shroud of Turin, for example. Again, it has no history at all before the middle of the 14th century. But at that time, it shows up, you know, around 1355, something like that. It shows up at a little church in north central France, in the possession of a soldier of fortune named Geoffroy de Charnay. And one could imagine that maybe he brought it back from the Holy Land, but he would not or could not say how he, a man of modest means, had acquired the most holy relic in all of Christendom.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing is there's a bishop's report to Pope Clement about this situation, and the reasoning at the time was that the local bishop and other theologians and so forth were skeptics of their day over this, because they wondered, how could there be a shroud of Jesus with his picture on it that the holy evangelists failed to mention? Why is it, they were saying, that it has remained unknown all these centuries? And that's a very good point.
The Pope was skeptical.
Yes. The bishop, particularly, at the time, was skeptical and took the matter to Pope Clement. He found that the shroud was not authentic.
Yeah. From what I understand, Joe, in the Middle Ages, holy relics were used for fundraising pieces, in order to like build a cathedral or a church around a relic. So there was actually quite a motivation for every local church to have one, and as
Absolutely.
A result, there was quite an industry of fake relics going around for a long time.
Exactly. You needed a relic to have a church. It's no coincidence, I think, that the Shroud of Turin shows up at the time that a little church was being built in Liri. And you have the same with crowns of thorns, even a single thorn, a piece of the true cross. And so these relics proliferated, and you had you had several crowns of thorns. It was John Calvin who said that there was enough pieces of the true cross to fill the cargo hold of a goodly ship. There were some 40 authentic shrouds, and of course skeptics are quick to realize that at least 39 of those were bogus.
At least, yeah.
There were two heads of John the Baptist.
So that brings up, you bring up, so the third big relic attributed to Jesus is the true cross, the cross on which he was crucified. And as you say, there were a lot of people claiming to have pieces of the cross. Of course, together they added up to something much bigger than the cross would have been. But are there any modern claims to having a piece of the cross that people are still promoting?
Well, of course, churches have them. I've seen a piece in a church in Italy that they have pieces of the true cross, you know, in reliquaries and on exhibit. How seriously are they taken? Well, there they are. no disclaimer.
Right.
Also, as part of the true cross, you know, the true cross was supposedly found by the mother of Constantine, Saint Helena. In 326 A.D., she went to Jerusalem, and supposedly by some means, visionary or otherwise, found the tomb of Jesus, and in it all kinds of relics, including the dismantled cross.
Mm-hmm.
And with the true cross, apparently, was the titulus, that is, the title board, you know, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews, written in three languages. And that has been the subject of a modern book and I believe, Discovery Channel television show suggesting that a piece of this titulus, might actually be the authentic piece of the real titulus. Unfortunately, I examined this claim, and for starters, there are paleographic errors, that is, errors in the writing. For example, the Greek is correctly written backwards in mirror image form, it's correctly done, except that one letter, Z, is not reversed. And it's hard to think that that this would be an error that would be made by someone who would produce the actual titulus. It's the kind of thing that's an error from somebody centuries later who sort of doesn't understand the languages and is copying something, or someone's told him what to do. Mm-hmm. There are several other mistakes with the lettering, and of course the true believers say no forger would make such a mistake, so it must be genuine. Whereas, of course, skeptics are aware that most forgeries are mixtures of things that are clever. The forger gets several things right, and then there are usually some errors as well. But in this case, the titulus, as with the Shroud of Turin, has been, I can reveal now, it's revealed in the book, it has now been radiocarbon dated. Does it date to the time of Christ? Or does it date to the Middle Ages? Or does it date to the time of Eisenhower's inauguration?
Sounds like science or fiction. Middle Ages is my
guess. Middle Ages. It dates early Middle Ages. It's dating from sometime between 980 and 1146 A.D. And that's about the time period. And this is quite often the case. It's really interesting when you look at the radiocarbon dating of these things. The date is usually consistent with the date it first showed up.
Yeah.
So it was made as a new piece of fakery. And the same with the Shroud of Turin. When it was radiocarbon dated, it yielded a date of 1260 to 1390. Now, if you split that, you get about the time the Shroud, a little earlier than the Shroud, is showing up.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, today's forgers know about carbon dating, so they will be... They will be trying to get old materials to do their fakery on. Now, I do, in Relics of the Christ, I not only deal with just the relics of Jesus, but I expand it a little more in the interests of completeness to talking about relics of Joseph and Mary and, of course, the disciples and some saints, just when they're interesting and so forth. And one of those that I talk about is the relic of St. Januarius. And, of course, that's a saint's relic that for years wasn't allowed to be tested, still isn't allowed to be tested, but some Italian friends in Italy and my forensic friend and I, John Fisher and I here, came up with some ways to duplicate the effect of the blood of St. Januarius. You know, it miraculously liquefies from time to time. And since dried blood can't actually liquefy, it must be a miracle, believers say, or skeptics would say, well, maybe it isn't really blood. Maybe it's something else. Been for many, many years, skeptics have been trying to figure out what could be in the vial that would make it do that. And our Italian friends came up with an idea of a thixotropic gel. John Fisher and I came up with an oil wax emulsion. We think ours would be something more compatible with the technology of the time, 14th century, when it showed up. But nobody would allow it to be opened. I mean, we could settle it very quickly, you know, if we could test the substance, we could see if it's actually blood. Our Italian friends did us one better. They found another church that had a similar miraculous vial. There are actually several of these in the Naples area. And they got permission to do non-destructive tests on it, to test their theory that it's a thixotropic gel, that is one that when you shake it, it thins out. They vigorously agitated the vial. Sadly, nothing happened. Then they decided to test in favor of our hypothesis that it was an oil wax emulsion, and that it liquefied by being warmed by body heat and candles and things. And so they warmed the vial slightly, whereupon a miracle occurred. And we think that that's probably the explanation for the Januarian phenomenon as well. But as you say, getting to test it has not that's been a problem.
Now, has anyone brought up the possibility of doing a non-invasive test such as spectroscopy? Would that work through the vial?
It might. In fact, there were claims that about 100 years ago or some such, that they did such a test. But, you know, it's like the Shroud of Turin. The tests are always done by the true believers. And they build in all the fudge factors.
Right.
They make all kinds of claims and stuff, and then nobody else is allowed to do it. There were claims made that it had a spectrum that helped prove that it was real blood. But again, if it doesn't behave like blood and doesn't seem to have the properties of blood, why should we think it's blood? Because I had a forensic blood expert examine this report, and he said that the technology of the time didn't tell you much more than it was within a certain shade of red.
I see.
about all it showed. If you used, let's say, red iron oxide as your pigment, which is what we used, what artists call red ochre, be very close to red in some ways.
Now, you mentioned before that modern forgers are getting a little bit wiser and they're looking for older material to start with to at least get past the carbon dating. Is that what happened with the James ossuary? Wasn't that a truly ancient material, but just the information on it was forged?
Yes, I think you're exactly right with the James ossuary. You know, that was of interest to me, particularly when it showed up, people wanting to know my opinion of it and so forth. I'm always very careful not to give opinions till I have some facts. So when the James ossuary, that is the ossuary that or bone box that showed up with Aramaic text saying Jacob, or in English James, son of Joseph, brother of Yeshua, Jesus. Biblical Archaeology magazine said, you know, Jesus written in stone. And when it showed up in at the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto, I said to some colleagues from the center, I said, why don't we go up there? Make a day of it. So we did, and photography wasn't allowed, but by my Irish gift of gab, I was able to persuade a guard to take a break. He went off on a break. And photographs mysteriously appeared on my roll of film.
It's a semi-miracle.
Yes. But when we went there, we noticed that everybody was pretty much drawn. You know, they would walk into the room and see where the ossuary was. They'd go right over and look for the inscription and then put their nose to it, looking very intently at the inscription. And I suppose that's a pretty natural way to do, but that's not what I did. I walked in, and I naturally kind of avoided doing that until I kind of stood well back and walked around the box, you know, kind of looking to see the context. What am I looking at here? And I had with me Ben Radford and Kevin Christopher, and Kevin could read Aramaic. And I said, Kevin, come over here. And I said, do you see on the other side of this, you know, we were looking now at the back side, the opposite side of the box. I said, do you see? Can you see these? Yes, yes, he said, I see them, these rosette designs. They were very faint. The box was old and ruffled and rugged looking and pitted. But just faintly you could see, but unmistakably see, these rosette designs. And I remembered that Biblical Archaeology magazine had assured us that there was nothing on this box except this inscription and a border.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, how could anybody miss this? We, as far as we knew then, we were the first people to notice this. But as it turned out, of course, the Royal Ontario Museum people noticed it right off. But the implications were pretty huge because these boxes were put into niches and were carved on one side. They were usually decorative and didn't have any wording on them. There's not much point in having decorations or a name or something on the back of it.
Yeah.
And so as I put it, I said, Kevin, this is a strange box. It has two fronts.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we walked up very close to it and saw this, absolutely looked like real old carving, you know, that had weathered. And then when you walked around the box and saw this carving, this inscription, as I said to Ben and Kevin, I said, it looks like it was done last week with a dentist drill.
Mm-hmm.
And we now know that, of course, that a dentist drill was and other fake antiquities were confiscated when at the home of the man who had this, Oded Gilron. And he's under, I'm not sure what the current disposition of the case is, but he was under, the group of them, under indictment for antiquities forgeries. And yet, still, Biblical Archaeology Magazine and others have suggested that maybe, you know, it's authentic after all. And Steve, to get back to what you were talking about using an old object for a modern forgery. And I think that's exactly what happened. I think someone got a genuine old ossuary and thinking it was blank or noticing rosette designs, but just turning it around and using the blank other side, decided to
do a value-added procedure to the ossuary.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And it's an old, you know, in my career of examining things and occasionally doing document authentications and so forth, I've come across so many of these because people have trouble getting, you know, making old artifacts. That's the hard part, or making an old sheet of paper. It's easier to just get an old sheet of paper somehow, or get, if you want a fake Daniel Boone rifle, you get a genuine old rifle. And then you carve...
Property of Daniel Boone.
Right, exactly.
But then, of course, it's hard to age the actual inscription that you make, because that leaves evidence that it's a fresh inscription and not one that was made.
That's right. And so the James ossuary, apparently there were a couple of things done, and these are still under contention, you know, that for one thing, Oded Gilron said that it was cleaned, that they cleaned it, and that removed the patina of age in the inscription, and that's why it looked the way it looked. Well, I don't really buy that. Only an idiot would have done that, but let's suppose that he did it. But then they try to have it both ways, and they say there are traces of the patina still in the letters that prove that it's really old. But the Antiquities Authority is saying that a fake patina has been added.
Joe, let's turn to your second book, Adventures in Paranormal Investigation, and I'll point out at this point that Joe is the senior researcher for the Center for Skeptical Inquiry, formerly PSYCOP. But you've been there for a number of years, basically doing all the investigation for the group.
I've been there since 1995, and it's my full-time job. So I produce these investigations, and they appear in Skeptical Inquirer and Skeptical Briefs and a few other places from time to time, and then every so often I collect a bunch of them into a book. And this is my third such collection. My first one was Real Life X-Files, followed by Mystery Chronicles, and this one, Adventures in Paranormal Investigation. So it has, I think, some of my best work.
Are there any that stick out for you, any of the investigations in this book?
Well, there are a number. I begin with The Haunted Plantation, which is a story of what's supposed to be, in some quarters, held to be the most haunted house in America, the Myrtles Plantation in Louisiana. I was asked by Discovery Channel, how would you like to spend a night in the most haunted place in America?
Now, wait a minute, Joe.
Yeah.
Everyone knows that the most haunted place in America is Ed and Lorraine Warren's basement. They told us.
Well, of course, other than that.
I mean, they told us directly that was the case. I mean, you know.
Can't argue with them.
That's right. The Myrtles could only have, an ordinary haunted house could only have the few ghosts that actually grew up there. But the Warren's basement could have haunted dolls and artifacts from all over, couldn't it?
They probably have. They've been importing ghosts there for years.
I'm still waiting for those curses to get me, because remember they said don't touch anything. If you touch anything, then remember they gave us an example of somebody who actually touched one of the artifacts in their basement, and he died soon thereafter. So, of course, when Ed wasn't looking, I was touching everything I could touch. And, I'm, you know, 10 years ago, I'm still waiting for something bad to happen.
Oh.
Maybe that's why I didn't win the lotto. Okay.
Yeah, I too like to challenge those claims. I was in a great, huge pyramid in the Moscow area, this is one of those. They're building several of these, and they remember the old claims about pyramids, that they would preserve food and sharpen razor blades and
pyramid
all
power.
Kinds of magical things. Well, they this crank has built these giant pyramids. So we went to one of them, and of course it was closed. And once again, you know, I had to bring out the dollars, and you find that the place can be opened. So we went inside, and they were energizing bottles of water. There were just cases and stacks of these cases of bottled water being energized, you know, to produce healing water and so forth. And there was a particularly central cordoned off area, and the guy, you know, said, you know, that it would not be safe to stand there because the power was just so tremendous. And I said, oh, well, I'll take a risk.
Yeah.
Before he could do anything, I was ducked under the rope and had my friend take my picture. And as you can see, I was hardly killed.
Hardly.
So energized bottled water, that's like a double scam. Because bottled water itself is already a scam.
Yeah, right.
But anyway, that story is not in the book. But
so you were telling us about the other most haunted place in America.
Well, the Myrtles Plantation. Discovery Channel asked how I would like to spend the night there, and so I did. I stayed the whole night, and they gave me an infrared viewer and
a ghost-o-meter.
And I wandered about. At night. I don't use the electronic equipment. I think that's sheer pseudoscience. But I did make good use of the infrared viewer because I wanted to examine a painting that supposedly had some mysterious blood traces and so forth, and I thought maybe infrared would be helpful. But I couldn't find the bloody handprint anywhere. Nobody's been able to. But I examined all the things there, and the show aired, and they handled it with some amusement. They had a couple talking about their experiences there and how they heard these strange banging noises. And as the film was rolling, you the listener hear these similar strange noises banging away, and then they say, "Is it the ghost?" And they say, "No, it's just Joe again." And they cut to me out back of the house, having found a loose shutter, and I was banging it back and forth. So they had some fun with that show, but we were also there with some ghost hunters, and they did bring in their equipment, and I think they left about, I don't know, maybe before midnight or something. So I was actually I was the only one in the house ultimately to spend the night, but they were there with their, you know, motion detectors and cameras to photograph orbs and their electromagnetic detection devices and so forth, all of which is just nonsense.
Yeah,
as we all know, it has no, you know, there's no evidence that ghosts have magnetic personalities.
So nothing happened, right? Because you were there, which always happens. We go to these ghost hunts. When the skeptic's there, nothing happens.
Pretty much nothing happened. There was an orb in a photo or two, easily explained, and that was pretty much it.
But did the show try to make something out of it, or were they comfortable with the negative
results?
The show
was really trying to sort of, you know, make a mysterious story out of it.
Yeah.
Joe, when you're in a house like this overnight, when you're invited overnight, do you actually pretty much stay up all night kind of walking around, checking things out, or do you actually catch a few Z's, or what's the usual...
I try to do a little of everything. I'm usually tired at the end of a long day and need some rest. But it's also good to be able to, you know, to be alone and in a house, and to so I stayed up a while and made my way around. It's a large many room plantation house, and it's quite a big place. And I slipped around in my jammies, you know, and looked at some of the things that were some of the activities were supposed to be, to see if anything had happened. There's a bed that's supposedly gets rumpled, and I kept checking those things, but I did finally go to bed, and then I got up early, and I actually got up in the middle of the night and did another bunch of rounds, you know, and tried to listen and see if there were things happening, noises or things that I might trace the source of.
Any ectoplasm or?
No, I didn't find any ectoplasm. Of course, I never have any great waking dreams, but... The trouble is, if I had one, I'd know what it was anyway.
Well, Joe, what's the next project you're working on? What's the next book that you're planning?
Well, I've got several things on the drawing board. And one of them is a book called Tracking the Man-Beast. And I'm looking at all the kinds of creatures that are sort of a cross between man and animal in some way. Bigfoot, of course, werewolves, Mothman, and so forth, Honey Island Swamp Monster, any kind of... It's going to be pretty inclusive, and I'm trying to put together all the different types of man-beasts in one volume. But I have several others on the drawing board and working on several projects and trying to keep busy.
Well, you're very prolific. We look forward to your future books. We'll certainly have you back on when your next book comes out.
Okay, good. I forget how many books I've written, 20 some. I'm sure it's approximately 18 too many, but it's addictive. Addictive. And a new book comes out and I admit that for a couple of days I sort of clutch it to my breast. It feels very good to have a new book out, and then after a couple of days or so you think, it's just a book. Mm-hmm. You know, you're on other projects that are much more interesting than or so they seem. And you know, they promise you when you're very young that someday you could grow up and be rich and famous, and I've become infamous and broke. Close,
only a couple letters off. All right, Joe, thanks again for joining us. Always a pleasure.
Good talking with you, Joe.
Yes, keep up the good work there.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Joe. Good
night.
Take care.
It's time for Science
check.
Or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. And, of course, you all can play along. Are you guys ready for this week?
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Here we go. Number one, the Chinese National Space Administration today launched a rocket that will carry a satellite into low lunar orbit and is a prelude to their planned lunar landings. Item number two, spectroscopic analysis has revealed a surprisingly high concentration of gold in the outermost A ring of Saturn's rings. And item number three, physicists have created a super heavy isotope of aluminum previously thought to be impossible. Bob, you've been away for a while, so why don't you go first this week?
Okay. See, number one, the CNSA launched the rocket. I'm going to say that is science. Number three, physicists have created a super heavy isotope of aluminum. I'm going to say that is science as well. And number two, spectroscopic analysis. High concentration of gold in the outermost A ring of Saturn's rings. Ha! I think I know what you're doing there, Steve. I'm going to say that's fiction.
Okay. Evan.
Well, I'm going to jump on the bandwagon of one and and agree with Bob. Now, I will make note, Steve, this is the second time you've mentioned spectroscopic tonight. It came up in the Joe Nickel interview.
Yes, that's right.
Earlier, so I'm not sure if that was meant to be a curveball of some kind, but I'll go ahead and agree with Bob about... gold in the outer... What did I read recently? Somewhere in a book about gold forming naturally, like in a collapsed star or something like that, but
supernovas will create those heavier elements and then spew them out into space.
This was specifically gold, but in any case, I agree with Bob.
So you have a unanimous vote between the two of you. Let's start with the first one. The Chinese National Space Administration today launched a rocket that will carry a satellite into low lunar orbit and is a prelude to their planned lunar landings. That is science. Not that obscure a piece.
Big rush on the moon of late.
Yeah.
Some people claim that the country or company that gets their hands on, what's the element? Tritium? Is it tritium? That supposedly tritium would be extremely helpful in fusion for fusion energy. Is it tritium? Mm-hmm. I forget. So now there's supposedly a big tritium rush that whoever can get their hands on that will have a big leg up in fusion research.
And what does that have to do with the moon?
apparently it's rich in this element. that
the regolith or something? The lunar regolith has a lot of tritium in it?
I'm not sure if it's in the regolith or if it's a little deeper, but the moon is definitely much more rich in that element than Earth is.
So all kinds of stuff up there. Well, the CNSA launched a rocket called Chang'e 1 from the Zhicheng Satellite Launch Center in Sichuan atop a Long March 3A rocket. This represents the first step in their ambition to land robotic explorers on the moon before 2020. No mention of it landing any people on the moon, just robotic, which is, you know, that's a discussion we've had on this podcast a few times before, the relative bang for the buck that you get out of robotic exploration versus people exploration. The Chinese are obviously going the robotic route, at least for now. Item number two. Spectroscopic analysis has revealed a surprisingly high concentration of gold in the outermost A-ring of Saturn's rings, and this one is fiction.
Fiction.
So you guys, both of you got it correct.
Yeah, it's really debris from, a broken-up moon that they found, little moonlets.
Yes, what they did find in the outermost A-ring of Saturn is a ring of moonlets, which are, you know, larger chunks than the stuff that usually comprises... That we know of usually comprises these of Saturn's rings, which are really dust and ice and rocks.
This is like they say
these are as big as
camper trucks and as big as like the Astrodome or something like that.
Yeah, as big as like a sports stadium on the big side. And they think that there was a moon there that got pulverized by a strike with an asteroid or a comet or something, smashed into it, broke it into a lot of pieces, you know, but bigger pieces than the regular rings. And there's actually now ringlets of these little moonlets.
Couldn't tidal forces have also ripped it apart? Because I believe the rings of Saturn are within the Roche limit, and any debris orbiting a planet within that limit will eventually rain down onto the planet. So at some point in the future, the rings of Saturn will disappear.
So the question is, did the tidal forces break up the moon because it got too close, or did it just break up because something smashed into it and it didn't coalesce again into a moon because it was inside the Roche limit, which I think is what they're saying. That's the leading hypothesis. So the gold bit I made up.
Yeah. I saw that one.
I was trying to think of something. At one point, I decided that's going to be my fiction. So, what could I say is in Saturn's rings that would be plausible enough that you might go for it, but definitely something that's not true and you should be a little suspicious of. So that's what I came up with. Not impossible, but imagine if there were like just chunks of gold in Saturn's rings. Would be ships going out there mining them one day.
I guess.
Gold in them. There are rings. Which means that physicists have created a super heavy isotope of aluminum, previously thought to be impossible, is science.
Interesting stuff. I read about that. That's interesting. I didn't realize that scientists had only worked out with about six elements.
Eight.
How many? Was it eight?
Yeah, eight elements.
Eight elements of how heavy, you know, the maximum, you know, the isotopes. And how many neutrons the nucleus can have, and all the rest of the elements, they really were not sure, you know, how heavy these isotopes could be, and they're just blown by some of these theories that other scientists have made about how heavy these isotopes can be.
With aluminum, so what we're talking about is the number of neutrons and protons in the nucleus of elements. The type of element is determined by the number of protons. Because that determines its chemical properties. The number of neutrons doesn't really affect the chemistry of that element, but that just affects its atomic weight. And so different numbers of neutrons are called different isotopes. And the question is, how many neutrons can you have on any given element and still have the nucleus hold together? Because, you know, there is a tendency for the nuclei to fall apart, and it is the residue of the nuclear, well, it's the nuclear forces that hold them together, but if it gets too big, then the forces will not be able to hold the neutrons and protons together, and that's called the drip line. Did you know that word, Bob?
Whenever the article I
yeah, that's the first time I saw that that term was when I read this too. Article. The neutron drip line, which is the maximum number of neutrons that an element can hold in its nucleus. And that's what you're saying. We only know that what the drip line is for about eight elements, the first eight, the smallest eight. And for the rest, we don't. So they hypothesized, you know, that what the maximum size of an aluminum isotope could be, and now they've and also magnesium, and now they made one isotope of magnesium 40, which has 12 protons and 28 neutrons, and they also made aluminum 42, 13 protons and 29 neutrons, and aluminum 43, 13 protons and 30 neutrons. So this creates a substance which has all the chemical properties of aluminum, but it's just really heavy because it has all these extra neutrons in it. So it's like this super heavyweight aluminum.
Now, I wished when I read the article that they explained, first off, how stable is it? I mean, it's kind of a relative
right.
term. When they say stable, it makes me think that maybe they can eventually produce these in mass quantities. And what would the benefit be of like a super heavy aluminum? It's just some novel applications for some of these things that I wish they kind of addressed that. Maybe they really don't know yet.
I don't think they know. And they do say, first of all, these were made in a powerful accelerator. And they characterized it as the fleeting appearance of these nuclear isotopes.
Gotcha.
So I don't think that
they... long.
Yeah, so there wasn't a beam of aluminum 43.
But if it was fleeting, they're still calling it stable.
Well, enough that they could detect it. I mean, I guess that's a relative term, but it was enough that they could detect that it existed at all.
And what force overcomes the nuclear force at that point that it falls apart?
No. Well, the protons, because they all have a positive charge, repel each other,
right.
And the nuclear force has to overcome that.
Yeah, the article also mentioned that the neutrons seem to like to bundle up in pairs, and that's why they thought odd
stability.
Numbers wouldn't be as stable.
Right. So yeah, that was a bit surprising as well.
Yeah.
So congratulations, guys. Those are all interesting news items.
Yeah.
I was toying with the idea of making this one the fiction, and I was almost tempted, but I thought it would be just too easy.
What
I was going to say was that nuclear physicists made a super heavy isotope of aluminum that is transparent in the visible spectrum.
Transparent.
Oh, aluminum. I would
have. Yeah, Star transparent Trek. Aluminum. Yeah, right. Yeah, Star Trek reference. I thought it was too easy for you nerds. I almost couldn't resist it, though. It would have been funny.
I know.
That would have
been good.
All right, Evan. Can you please read last week's puzzle and give us the answer?
Last week's puzzle was as such. If I take 11 people, 4 bodies, a fiend, and a disc, along with 4 qualities, and I put them between a vehicle and a building, what do I have? And the answer, it is, in fact, the major arcana from a tarot deck, or deck of tarot cards. The major arcana is the part of the tarot deck. It consists of 22 cards. And they have, various symbols and people on them and so forth. So if you actually go through and you count what all these pictures in these 22 cards adds up to be, that's how you come up with that sum of people and objects and
what's
things.
The vehicle and the building?
The vehicle is the chariot,
mm-hmm.
And the building is called the tower. There's also temperance, judgment, strength, and justice. Those are the 4 qualities.
Mm-hmm.
The disc is the a wheel, and a fiend is the devil. 4 bodies are the sun, the moon, and the star, and the world, and everyone else is people in some
right.
form or another. High priestess and a fool and an emperor. You can actually go to Wikipedia and take a look at that. And the winner, or the first person to correctly guess, was Jedi Kangaroo from the message boards. And it was actually his first time posting. And he figured it out, and he actually put the link up there on the message boards to the Wikipedia entry on that. So go have a look at it, and congratulations to Jedi Kangaroo.
Well done.
Well done.
And what's our puzzle for this week?
Puzzle this week is as such. It's a rhyme. It's not a limerick, but a rhyme nonetheless. Okay, perhaps it is performed by folks in an arena, or perhaps by a person saying hello. Perhaps it's a style of filaments on Christina, or practiced by those who disturb the status quo. It claims it will cure us of our alopecia, along with 100 other things, but I doubt that it's so. What is it that I'm describing?
Okay. Well, thank you, Evan. Always interesting.
Thank you.
Jay is out this week, so Evan, you are going to do the quote for the week as well.
This week's quote is as follows. The value of a college education is not the learning of many facts, but the training of the mind to think. Mr. Albert Einstein.
Very nice. What,
a very quotable figure in history.
Yes, very
now,
quotable.
Steve, remember this when you go to the University of Connecticut tomorrow and as part of a panel discussion that's going to be on homeopathy.
That's right. There's a panel discussion on homeopathy being sponsored by UConn. I was roped into taking one of the skeptical positions up. Someone had to do it.
And remember this quote when you're there, because you're going to be helping fill some skulls full of mush with with some new ways of thinking about things,
right.
I'm sure.
Now, of course, by the time you're hearing this, the conference will have already happened. I did announce it on our webpage and the forums, so hopefully people heard about it. And on next week's show, I'll give you the full report about how it went. It should be fun.
Cool. Can't wait to hear it.
So thank the two of you for joining me this week.
Good episode.
Thank you, Doctor.
It was a good show.
It was good.
Good to be back.
A lot of fun.
Yeah, welcome back, Bob. I hope that your Halloween activities have concluded, at least enough that we'll get you back on the show. Next week we're actually going to do a Halloween-themed show.
Oh,
we're going to
record
it on the night before Halloween. And, Bob, you're definitely going to be there for that one, right?
Yeah, I can't miss that one.
Oh, right. How could you miss that? Right. Please.
So until next week... This is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. Please send us your questions, suggestions, and other feedback. You can use the Contact Us page on our website, or you can send us an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission. Endless delays.